Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to our very special 4th of July edition of Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and we're taking this holiday as an opportunity to kind of think in depth about the state of our society and most especially about the wisdom our Catholic faith offers towards restoring and rehumanizing the modern world. Our guest this hour has been thinking about such things, you might call them first things, for a very long and fruitful time. Rusty Reno, who publishes as R.R. Reno, is the editor of First Things magazine and the prolific author of such books as Fighting the Noonday Devil, In the Ruins of the Church, and the one I suspect we will take the most time on today, Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society. Rusty Reno, thank you so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Live.
A pleasure to be with you.
Well, I want to start by asking you, because it's the 4th of July, and this will be broadcast on the 4th of July. We're recording a little earlier, but I wanted to ask you about the American dream, because we have come to think of the American dream in materialistic terms, as you write in Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, but you say that's not really what the American dream is. Could you say something about that?
We often think the American dream is to get rich. My experience is that Americans are like any other human beings. More is better than less. But that's not really what is the dream, I think, that's at the heart of the American experiment. Instead, it's about freedom. And it's about the ability to shape your own future. And I think that that's very distinctive of Americans. I travel a lot. And people in other countries are aware of that. I mean, at its worst, it's this fetish about we can just reinvent ourselves at any moment. At its best, it's a kind of independent spirit that where people want to take responsibility for themselves and for their own families and shape their own futures. And so I think that's what I think is the American dream.
And the excesses of the American dream seem now to be all around us. I mean, you mentioned the idea.
Indeed.
So in your view, what got us here? How did we end up here where we seem to be living such an extreme version of a kind of, I suppose freedom is the word, but it's really a slavery, but I'm not sure exactly how to phrase it. Maybe you'll know.
Obviously, the kind of immediately comes to mind is this notion that I can control my destiny, even to the point of deciding I'm no longer a man, but instead a woman. You know, the Bruce Jenner phenomenon. And that I think for listeners epitomizes like, well, wait a minute. Okay. I can make my own future. I can make my own destiny. I like that, but wait. Obviously as religious believers, we know that we're created. We're finite. We can't, in fact, make our own futures. And there's a way in which the very essence of sin is to imagine or to live in the illusion that we can control our own futures. We can be our own masters. And so I think but there's something right about it at the same time. When St. Paul says that it's for freedom that Christ has set us free, he is speaking about our freedom from the slavery to sin and death that comes from obedience to Christ. And so there's something in the American dream that's both right and wrong at the same time. It's right to see self-mastery and self-command as the highest good, but of course it's a secular dream and not a religious dream, and so it can't really access the true source of that freedom. So, typical American problem, we kind of hover on this razor's edge of being, I mean, G.K. Chesterton said that the vices of the modern world are Christian virtues gone mad, and there's a certain way in which some of the greatest aspects of our society, which I dearly love and am very patriotic, are kind of elements of Christianity that are detached from their true Christian sources and can easily go very bad, very, very bad.
So do you accept the kind of proposition that says, well, that American democracy works as long as it is kind of mediated through and moderated by a Christian culture, but it won't work if we let go of that Christian culture?
Yeah, I think you could say that. I think, yes, that's Alexis de Tocqueville's insight, and I think that's undoubtedly true, that a liberal democratic system requires moral and religious ballast. And so freedom has to have a place to stand, as I talk about in my book, and that place to stand is a moral and religious truth. Now, I think it's possible to have a culture of freedom that has its roots in the Old Testament, in Judaism, as well as in Christianity, or even in, you know, the founding fathers, many of them were not Orthodox Christians and arguably were more influenced by a classical view, ancient Roman and Greek view of life. So I think we can have a pluralistic source of, if you will, moral substance in our society. But I think historically it's been Christianity has provided that for us. And so if we want to restore and renew our society, odds are it's going to require a Christian restoration, Christian renewal. But I don't want the listeners to think that this is the only way. I mean, they can have neighbors who draw their sense of moral rootedness, moral truth from other sources than the New Testament. And I think we can share a society with them, a healthy society with them. And we can join arms with them, link arms with them to try to put freedom back on its proper footing.
That's a fascinating point because there are folks that we can't link arms with and do that. And many of them seem to be, I don't want to be disrespectful, but teaching in universities or running newspapers these days, that there's such an extreme view of the individual as at utter liberty to do whatever one wants, including, you know, killing the innocent and that kind of thing, that I don't mean to say we can't link arms with them as fellow citizens, but we, intellectually and in the making of democracy, we can't be on their side.
No, I think the divide in our society is becoming more painful, more obvious and more painful. And the divide is not between Protestants and Catholics or between Jews and Christians, or for that matter, even between people who have a certain deeper philosophical sense of the reality of moral truth. But instead, it's a view that sees kind of the human person is better off when they can make up their own minds about truth versus those of us who think that the essence or the true source of freedom is loyalty to that which is true. And so a deeper and stronger moral culture is actually one that reinforces a culture of freedom. And I think that's a pretty deep divide in our society. And I agree with you that our universities are increasingly secular churches, so to speak, that right. indoctrinate young people into a religion of secularism and a religion of this kind of false view of freedom.
I'll ask you about the other side of our culture as well, that we face pressure from Islam, it seemed to me that the Regensburg address that Pope Benedict gave essentially asked a question of Islam, which is, you said, we have to be rooted in the truth, not just in the whim or in the will to power or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you agree with me that it seemed to that Pope Benedict was asking Muslims, can we share that with you? Do you in fact share with us this idea that we can reason together about the truth? And as a second question, I would like to, if you don't mind, do you think it's that Islam is going to continue to just put pressure from that side, or are there ways of being Muslim that are in fact democratic and rooted in reasoning about the truth together?
Yeah, these are hard questions. I think in the Regensburg address, Pope Benedict his very subtle mind was really operating in two different directions at the same time. On the one hand, it was a challenge to Islam as to whether or not its view of God is a view that sees also as a view of the primacy of reason, whereas God is somehow, in some sense, at odds with reason. And, our tradition sees faith and reason as ultimately pulling in the same direction. And that's important. But at the same time, subtly, he was challenging secular culture in the late modern period, which is, my fellow American citizens, or we'll put it with American, my fellow Europeans who are secularists, do you see our society being governed by reason or just by power? And because that's, if you look at the university campuses today, it's a lot about power and, shutting people down and shutting people up.
Yes, right.
And is there a kind of dark alliance, if you will, between a certain kind of radical Islam and a certain kind of radical secularism? That's how I read the Regensburg Address. And I think that there's, he doesn't spell it out, but it's a very suggestive connection that I think should make us aware of the difficulty of what we're up against.
Yeah,
The way in which we as Catholics have to stand for the authority of revelation and the dignity of reason, and that throughout the modern era, the Enlightenment wanted to tell us that those two things were at odds with each other. And I think the 21st century is going to increasingly show that they actually need each other. And the authority of revelation that the Muslims affirm needs reason. And I think we can help them with that. And I think that the secularists who want to be loyal to reason, they need the authority of revelation in order to sustain the dignity of reason, and we need to help them with that. So I think we have a very special role to play going forward.
That which will bring us to the question of religious freedom and its role in this American culture. We got to take a quick break. R.R. Reno, the editor of First Things Magazine, is our guest this hour for a very special 4th of July edition of Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back with more right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know that there's a place you can turn first that features the newest, most exciting Catholic resources, as well as a huge selection by some of the best Catholic authors and speakers on the planet? It's our online store at shop.catholic.com. All of our offerings are time-tested and apologist-vetted and trustworthy and faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And, of course, the lights are always on for your shopping convenience. It's one-stop shopping made affordable and easy. Shop.catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 8:23, the disciples were out at sea as Jesus slept peacefully, when a violent storm erupted and the boat began to take in water. The terrified disciples woke him, and he calmed the sea. We might reflect on the erupting storms that daily break on our bow, the bow of our troubled world, and on how many times we have been worried and frightened. And how many times have we prayed, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." Do you think that the Lord is any farther from us than he was from them on that storm-tossed boat? Not at all, nor is he any less aware of our plight than he was of theirs. "Why are you so terrified, you of little faith?" he said to them, and to us as well. With them, our ultimate safety lies in him alone. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And a very happy 4th of July to you. Thank you for spending part of your 4th of July with us. We hope we're offering you some thinking that fits with the 4th of July in both hours today. Some thinking about the nature of our democracy and the nature of a Catholic's role in that democracy. Our guest this hour, Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things magazine. And Dr. Reno, when we concluded, I said I wanted to ask you some things about religious freedom. And the Supreme Court ended its term with a significant decision having to do with the state's relationship with religious institutions. I would assume you would say the court got that one basically right. And the decision, just for the listeners, in case you're not familiar with it, there was a the state of Missouri was – is am I right, Missouri?
Yes, it's Missouri.
The state of Missouri was giving out grants to schools for safety, and a Lutheran school applied for one of these safety grants to get some materials for their playground and were denied on the basis that they were a religious school, which from one perspective would be discrimination against a religious school, and from another perspective would be maintaining the wall between church and state. And I suppose both could be true. I wonder what your take on that decision and what it says about the religious freedom in America.
I was not surprised by the decision. I think it's the right decision. It was a 7-2 decision. So the court really very strongly pushed back against the state of Missouri's, I think, wrong interpretation, as the court decided, false interpretation of the disestablishment element of the First Amendment. And I think that what we see here is a pendulum swinging in our society. You know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the court instituted a kind of rigorous disestablishment jurisprudence. You know, a lot of it revolved around prayers at high school graduations. And the notion here was to try to protect the beleaguered unbeliever from, you know, being completely swallowed by a religious culture. Well, times have changed. And it's not the case that we, you know, nobody who's got their eyes open could think that somehow America is this overwhelmingly religious nation now. We know that the rise of 20% or more people now say they have no religious affiliation at all. And so I think the court is readjusting and saying, wait a minute. We have to protect against the discrimination against religious people rather than protect the non-believers. So I think we're going to see the court being solicitous towards religious freedom going forward.
Now, and how do you respond? I imagine you might get this, that you wrote a book called Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, and then a person who says, well, you have a secret agenda. The reason you want this kind of money for a Lutheran school or whatnot, Rusty Reno, is you're trying to slide us back into being dominated by religion.
Yes. I think it would be good for our society for religion to have a greater influence on young people, on our society as a whole. But there's a big difference between allowing space for the church to flourish versus the government picking and choosing which churches get to run things, so to speak. And I firmly support our constitutional system, which is a system that prohibits any one religious group from using the power of government to impose its own theological views on others. And that was one of the problems with the Missouri's state constitution, which had one of these so-called Blaine amendments. And Blaine was a politician in the late 19th century who thought he could get the upper hand politically by encouraging states to amend their constitutions to prohibit any funding of religious schools. And it was very clearly targeted against Catholics, who were the only body in the United States that had an independent school system. And so it was an attempt to, it was anti-Catholic legislation. And I think our system at its best does not allow people to use the power of law to secure special benefits for any one particular religion, but at the same time, it allows the state to encourage religiosity generally, which I think is the way historically we've proceeded in our society. Dwight Eisenhower famously said, "It's good for Americans to believe in, to have religious beliefs, and I don't care which one or what they are." I can't remember what he said exactly, but and he's often criticized for that. But I think there's something to that. If you look at Declaration on Religious Freedom from the Second Vatican Council, it's clear that the Council Fathers saw that religion is a natural good, that human beings are naturally oriented towards honoring the transcendent, the supreme being, and that a healthy society is one that helps people achieve that end. And so I think that we as Catholics ought to support our constitutional system of separation of church and state, and at the same time, without contradiction, urge our legislators to pass laws that provide a congenial environment for all religious people to pursue the work that they do and their missions.
Now, this just gives me a little bit of pause, and I want to just push you a little bit on this because I'm fascinated to hear what your answer will be. But we have these almost satirical religions now, like the Church of Satan and the Pastafarianism, and what these satirical religions do is go to court and demand that they be given the same rights as the Christian church down the street. It strikes me the court actually the courts haven't been very amenable to their religion, saying it's not real religion. But I wonder, how would you, in an atmosphere where you said there shouldn't be any particular religion preferred, does it extend all the way there?
No, I think the court can distinguish between real religions and made up ones. I don't think it's that hard. I mean, the courts are doing this all the time. I mean, you have certain. I run a nonprofit, 501c3. I get certain advantages. People can donate money and then deduct it from their taxable income, et cetera, et cetera. But the courts have to decide between when people set up nonprofits that are fake, and it's not always easy, actually.
Right.
And it's not just that they're skimming profits off of it. Maybe they're using the nonprofit in order to provide employment for their friends or their children or something like that. And so there are always these gray areas in the law when the courts have to decide not whether the law is a good law or a bad law or a constitutional law or unconstitutional law, but whether what people claim they are is really what they are. So I don't see this as a problem, and I think courts have been wise not to see this as a... I mean, you get law professors that say, well, you can't distinguish between a legitimate religion and a made-up religion, and my view is, of course you can.
In practice, you can, yeah.
Of course, we do it all the time. And could the courts get it wrong sometimes? Oh, of course. But the fact that it's hard sometimes to distinguish between night... The fact that there's dusk between night and day doesn't mean it's impossible to distinguish between when it's dark and when it's light.
Fair enough. All right. And so, but you do seem to be suggesting that, like you mentioned the 501c3s and all that, that religion should have even a privilege or a desire to kind of foster and protect the liberty of religion that goes even beyond, say, corporations or nonprofits of other kinds.
Which is what we have in the United States. I mean, I run a 501c3. It's this educational nonprofit. The least regulated entities in the United States are churches. In other words, the legislatures give churches a lot of leeway to do their work, and they have minimal regulatory burdens. And so we live in a society that historically has thought religiosity is for the best. It strengthens the moral character of citizens, and that moral citizens are more capable of governing themselves. And if you can govern yourself, you don't need a big government to run everything else. I think it'd been wise in that regard.
R.R. Reno, the editor of First Things magazine and the author of Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, is our guest this hour for this special edition for 4th of July. This is Catholic Answers Live. Much more to come right after this.
This is Archbishop J. Michael Miller of Vancouver, Canada, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded.
People really gravitate to David Andrews and his concern for the callers. That's not just talk. He really means it.
Tom and I are both converts. We've walked that path, and we try to walk it with the listeners at whatever stage of the journey they're on.
It's EWTN's first weekly radio-to-TV talk show. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television.
Summer is coming, and with it, teens, young adults, and even adult friends and family will find themselves with a lot of free time on their hands. The good news is that Catholic Answers has something to fill up that free time. Two great graphic novels that combine visual excitement and quirky humor with philosophy and theology. The Truth Is Out There and its sequel, The Big Picture, follow two heroes as they travel through time and space, discovering truths about life, God, the Church, and eventually embarking on an exciting adventure along the timeline of salvation history. These books are so appealing, we guarantee if you just leave them sitting around, someone in the household will pick them up and read, and better yet, enjoy and learn from them. The Truth Is Out There and The Big Picture are also great catechetical tools for youth ministry, college classrooms, campus outreach, high school programs, RCIA, and parish family programs, and more. The Truth Is Out There and The Big Picture are available individually or packaged together at a very special price. Get yours today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or visiting a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Happy 4th of July to you. Thanks for being with us here on Catholic Answers Live today. Very happy to get to spend this time with you. I'm very grateful you chose to spend the time with us. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and we're talking democracy, religion, faith, and society this hour with Rusty Reno, who is the editor of First Things magazine. Dr. Reno, if I could just ask you, how's First Things magazine doing? It seems in so many ways to have been a revolutionary publication in this dialogue of religion and public life. How do you feel it's doing now?
Well, only revolutionary insofar as common sense is sometimes revolutionary.
Certainly in this case it was.
Yeah, well, I think 2016 was a good year for us. It was a good year because the political earthquakes that went through our system all through 2016 caught the mainstream media off guard, and they got a lot of things wrong, and they've become less and less credible. And that means that more and more people are turning to these funny religious people who, you know, actually have something to say.
Yeah,
it might even be true.
Right.
Because, you know, I think people become secular. One of the dangers in secular America is that people make a god of politics.
Yes.
And it becomes sacred for them, and it can blind them. And I think that as religious people, we can sort of be more critical, step back, and say, no, hey, wait a minute, what's really going on here? And I would like to think that First Things does that very well.
And now, did you personally say at the beginning on January 1st of 2016, if I had said to you, here's how it's going to unfold, would you have thought me insane, or would you did you see something like what happened coming?
I did. I mean, I wrote about, I think by January 2016, I wouldn't say that, but I would say by March 2016, I was aware that the Republican Party establishment had lost touch with the voters, and that so I was not surprised by Trump's. Well, he always surprises you. I mean, it's kind of crazy, and it's hard to imagine that he could actually do it. But I wasn't surprised by the failure of the other candidates if you allow me to put it in the negative. Yeah. I mean, Reaganism, I think, has reached its use-by date. I mean, 1980 was a long time ago. It's not surprising that a certain set of political solutions have lost their salience because the problems have changed.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump had a kind of animal genius to recognize that and zero in on things that the voters cared about in his own blunt, blustering way. And then in the fall, I was agnostic. If you'd asked me who was going to win, I'd say I never thought that it was obvious that Hillary Clinton was going to win. I always thought that the mainstream media had an invested interest in saying that Trump couldn't possibly win. Because he had lambasted them so thoroughly that they wanted it as a preference bias.
I see, yeah.
They wanted him to lose, therefore he had to lose.
But there,
nobody could possibly run our country who doesn't have the support of all the smart people like me.
Right.
Is the way that the editors of the New York Times are thinking.
Yeah.
So therefore he can't run the country. Therefore he can't possibly be elected. But that's not logic.
No, it's not. And there's a way in which... there was a refusal, and I wonder about myself. Like, if I look back on it, I don't know that I saw just how completely out of touch the kind of acceptable narrative was, and that people had determined they were going to be heard now. They weren't going to be told this is the story of your America. They wanted to tell. They wanted to be listened to.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to Bakersfield, California, and you actually open your eyes, you realize things are not good
right.
for a lot of people.
Right.
And for a lot of different reasons. I mean, I'm not saying that Donald Trump has the answers, but
no.
he at least was willing to name the problem.
Well,
and I think that was really powerful for voters.
You know, Rusty, I think what's something that is indicative of that is very little talked about, is nobody spoke about addiction to opiates on the campaign trail but Donald Trump, and he did it every day, everywhere he went. And
yep.
that struck me as he somehow, I don't know how he did it, he saw this is actually the concern that people have. This is in the American family. This is destroying whole, you know, towns and areas of states and whatnot. And then he spoke up about it. And it's striking that I don't know what odd talent he has, because it's clear he also has great shortcomings. But he spoke about stuff that actually was real, not just pretend stuff, but like, hey, you know what? This opiate addiction is destroying America.
One thing that helped me during the cycle, you know, starting, as you said, in January of 2016, is that I would talk to the people who served me espresso, drove me around in taxis, served me food at restaurants, and just kind of engage them. So, like, you know, who are you voting for in the primary? And I think, you know, it was interesting. One guy was this immigrant from Azerbaijan, Jewish Bukharian Jew from Baku, Azerbaijan. Been in the United States 20 years, married, kids. I said, who are you going to vote for in the primary? This was New York primary. Oh, Trump. I said, what's with that? What's with Trump? And he said, I don't want my children to grow up in a country that doesn't get respected.
Wow.
And, you know, and you know, we, you know, overeducated people like me, we have all of these ideas about what makes the world run. And we lose sight of the fact that, you know, we've actually, you know, our vision has been narrowed. For all kinds of reasons, one of which is that we're kind of trained to think that it's all about economics. You know, and you read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and it's all about economics, all about economic growth. And I'm not poo-pooing that. I mean, like I said, more is better than less. Or if you read the New York Times editorial page, it's all about identity politics.
Right.
But then you go and talk to people, and you realize, actually, no, people are much more complicated.
Yeah.
And we have spiritual needs, and we have these deep needs for solidarity. I talk about this in my book, that and that patriotism. I mean, this one guy I met, elderly Hispanic gentleman, I mean, it just almost brings tears to your eyes. It talks about our founding fathers.
Yes, right, right. And, well, you know, it's when the idea of what a human being is gets so impoverished, then you got to come up with some idea. And it also struck me after the election, and I have to admit, no prescience about this. I was completely wrong about everything in the election year. But afterwards, reflecting on it, the story of a woman is a woman wants to be sexually liberated and have a great job, and therefore free contraception is what you say to her. And the story of, you know, any minority person is resentment. And the story of – and it goes on and on and on down the line, but that's not what a woman is. That's not what it is to be a minority person. And it's certainly – and the working class utterly just botched that, you know. And
well, I think we've lost sight of the we.
Yeah,
the ruling
right.
class in America has lost sight of the we, the power of we.
Well, what do we if we could move then to our Catholic faith, and that and you're a convert to Catholicism, but you were mm-hmm. raised in a Christian home as a Anglican, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what is there in the in our Christian faith, and maybe more specifically in our Catholic faith, that speaks to the, it's a bizarre moment. I mean, it's very hard to get a read on where we are. I mean, you sound like you have a better read on it than I do. I am just baffled day by day about where are we and what direction are we going?
Well, I think we don't want to live for ourselves.
Ah, yeah.
And if you look at the anthropology, the view of the human person that we're educated to believe in our universities now is very materialist. You know, that we're a bundle of interests, self-interest, and then we pursue our own self-interest. Now, of course, we do that too. I mean, I'm not denying that we don't do that, but there's something else going on too, which is that we want to serve. We don't want to be served. And you know, John Paul II recognized that and saw that was a very powerful driver. So I think one thing that we can do is that people, the nationalism, the patriotism, but make America great again, et cetera, is people's desire to be loyal to something greater than themselves. That's great. That's good. We should encourage that. But we also need to help people recognize that's fine. Be loyal to your family. Be loyal to your country. But recognize that your loyalty to God is the highest loyalty, and that it will correct and limit and purify these lower loyalties. So people don't become clannish. That's always a vice of a certain kind of family loyalty that becomes excessive. Or people don't become nationalistic in the bad sense, and that can be a perversion of patriotism. So I think that's one really important thing that we as religious people, as Catholics especially, I think, can offer. Because Catholicism is not, Protestantism can be very iconoclastic, and you have to sweep away all the competing loyalties. Catholicism is more about recognizing the legitimacy of natural loyalties, but then putting them in the what I would call the proper order of love, where love of God is the highest and orders all the other loves towards love of God.
Do you? You're making me think of your chapter in the Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, the one on Seek Higher Things.
Yes.
And there you're essentially saying we need to I don't know how to teach the young that sacrificing for something higher is what they are for. Is that what you're referring to now?
Well, so I gave it the title Seek Higher Things because we live in a pluralistic society. You know, I affirm the constitutional separation of church and state. So as citizens, we need to go into the public square and say, hey, you may not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and you may not believe that the church in union with the Bishop of Rome is the one true church of Christ. But at least we can join together and say that in our schools and in our public culture, we should encourage people to seek things that are higher than their material interests. And if that means, you know, let's not buy into this purely vocational curriculum.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Let's not accept success, material success, as the be-all and end-all of life. And I think this would just help people at a human level lead fuller lives, but also helps us politically because we can identify the things around which we're united. that transcend our obvious competitions of interest. It's natural for us to quarrel over our interests in politics, and a healthy democracy allows for that. But a healthy democracy is also anchored in a shared love of something greater. You know, and for us, it's the American project, which is very ill-defined. As I said, it's the American dream that that we can be united in. We all want to serve that, although we fight about how best to serve it. And I think that's the key to civic peace, even amidst inevitable political competition.
When we come back, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Reno, about maybe where we go as Christians moving forward. You know, there are various proposals, the Benedict option and the Francis option, and we hear all those things. And maybe there's a little also a sense of being a bit demoralized. Our children are not practicing the faith in many, many cases and those kinds of things. I want to get your view on next steps for us as Christian people in this society. This is Catholic Answers Live. R.R. Reno, the editor of First Things magazine, is our guest this hour. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord Himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, track, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my new book, Why We're Catholic. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com. and take advantage of our very special prices. These materials will build up your faith because they're from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Well, I'm enjoying the broadcast. I'm having a great hour getting to talk with R.R. Reno, the editor of First Things magazine, on this 4th of July, where we consider our American society, our the place of Christians, and particularly Catholic Christians within that society. I do want to ask you, I mentioned a little bit before about, okay, so where do we go from here? How should we think of ourselves? I mean, there's I mentioned the Benedict option, and I guess you can't think about the Christian future without at least mentioning the Benedict option anymore, because it's on everyone's tongue. Pope Francis seems to be have a different proposal than the Benedict option. There is a sense of, wow, things have gone wrong, and we Christians need now to start again. Would you agree with that assessment?
I'm a conservative. I'm not in favor of starting again.
Would you agree with the basic assessment that something has gone wrong?
I'm not sure about that either.
Okay.
I think we got to be careful not to run around saying the sky is falling. There's been no decline in the percent of Americans going to church over the last two generations. Something like 25 to 35% of Americans are going to church on any given Sunday. And that's been the case for probably 100 years. So what's the change is that it used to be that that 25 to 35% set the tone for the rest of society. Whereas now, increasingly, there this rise of the percent of unaffiliated people, people with no religious connections, and they're now 20 to 25%. And so what we're experiencing is a kind of competition for the soul of our culture. The irreligious are getting more and more frustrated with the continuing influence of the religious over America's public culture. So they're pushing very hard to get us out of the public square. That's why First Things was founded, is to say, no, we're not going to leave. We're going to speak here in the public square as religious people. So I think that listeners need to sort of take a deep breath. Yes, our society has changed a lot in the last generation, but it is not the case that the church is in decline.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate your distinctions, but if you do say there's a battle for the soul of our culture, maybe a way to ask the question is, what are the tools and tactics for emerging triumphant in that battle for the soul?
Well, I want to distinguish here. The church is not at risk. What's at risk is the health of our society.
Ah, okay.
Because you and I believe that we need to have a strong moral and religious foundation for a free society, and that what happens as religion is pushed to the margins is that more and more people are abandoned to their own vices, and they become actually enslaved and not free. And we don't want that for our fellow citizens. So we want to maintain our voice in public matters, but we should never think that somehow, if we lose that battle, somehow the church is going to be at risk. No. In some ways, we're better off now than we have been for a long time, insofar as the choices are much clearer to young people than they ever were before. And my experience is with young people know that that the faith is actually not just being a good middle-class American. I mean, it really means actually believing something and doing something about your faith.
That's very encouraging, actually, to hear you say that. And I hadn't thought of it in those terms. And we do see, I mean, even you probably see them in the offices of First Things. We see them here at Catholic Answers, these young people, whether they're married couples or singles, who are very grounded in their faith. They're normal people. They're not fanatics, but they have a kind of grounding in their faith. They're not just rolling with the contraceptive culture. They're not just rolling with the hyper-individualism. They're about something. They're about Christ, to be frank. And so maybe you're right that the choices become starker for them than perhaps it was for our generation.
I think so. And so it's definitely changed, and that means that there are new challenges and new difficulties. But yeah, I want to avoid. I think one of the problems with Rod Dreher's Benedict option is it's too crisis driven.
And I see.
I don't believe that we're facing a crisis. I think the West is facing a civilizational crisis, and it's a. You know, probably it's rooted in the fact that, you know, we've, since the end of World War II, we've been in a kind of continuous consensus that's been running for 70 years, and it's just natural that that was going to break down.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is forever in the city of man. And so we all feel those, and that's the whole Trump election and all is shocking and all that sort of thing, and it's a sign of how our culture and our politics is in the midst of great changes, and that affects the church, of course. You know, the church is part of the world; it's in the world, even if it's not of the world. But I look at the rising generation of priests. There are some religious orders that are experiencing renewal; it's very positive. And as you mentioned, younger Catholics that have a very clear sense that. You know, they have to know what it is they believe, and they have to try to live it. We all fail, of course, but But they're more aware of their need to actually try and strive. So I look at the future, and I don't find myself in a dour mood. Part of it is so much is dissolving. Let's say that I'm right about this crisis in the West. You see it with populism in Europe, and so much is dissolving and is unsteady. And in that environment, the church, I say, will be affected and it will be made more unsteady. But the church could wind up being, you know, the only thing stable in an increasingly fluid and world of flux. So I think this may be that we may be entering a season where the church actually looks pretty good compared to in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
But that you say, it seems like we've almost come back again then to the monasteries of Saint Benedict. That you're saying that the church is.
Well, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm.
So that we function then in a society. I mean, it's not a very hopeful view for the survival of the United States, I would say. Like it seems you seem that if there's a civilizational crisis, we really don't know what will happen to these political institutions that we have,
to
these nation states and all that. But the hopeful side of it for you is that the church is not in danger, that it has.
Well, I would say this. I think the universities are being absorbed into what I call the kind of corporate industrial complex.
Yeah.
And so the distinctive university culture that was born in the Middle Ages, in the womb of the church, and then became independent and everything, I think that culture is now ending. That institution is now ending. And my grandchildren, I'm not confident, will be able to go to a university in the sense that I did.
Yeah.
And I grieve for them. That's not good. But I am confident that there will be churches, there'll be synagogues. The church and the synagogue are the only institutions that survive from antiquity. And by many, now that the university is going the way of all flesh, they're the only things that survive from the Middle Ages. And some people would say that the limited liability corporation is in some sense an invention of the early modern period. And so really, the church and the synagogue may be the only institutions that survive from the early modern period.
Yeah.
So I look at that and think, well, you know, we don't know, as you said, what's going to happen to our democratic institutions. I mean, 225 years is a very long time for a constitution.
Yes.
A written constitution. The British solved their problem by
not writing it down. Yeah.
So they can always claim it endures.
Well, I apologize for this. But we only have about a minute and a half left. So I'm a Catholic and I'm an American citizen. What are my obligations now, or maybe just one obligation that I have going forward on this from this 4th of July?
We have an obligation to serve our country as best we can and to care for it and nurture it. But we should always remember that it's a finite thing, the city of man, and that our ultimate loyalty rests in the city of God.
Thank you so much. R.R. Reno publishes under R.R. Reno. Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society is the book we talked most about today, but you got lots of books, and people can find your writing every month in First Things.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and enjoy everybody. Enjoy their 4th of July.
Thank you very much, Dr. Reno. Coming up next, Dr. Helen Alvarez will be with us to talk about the feminist movement and something called Women Speak for Themselves, a new movement she herself says she accidentally started. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back with more 4th of July edition right after this.